good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting to order, the Transportation Policy and Finance, and welcome all of you here. And we will try and stay punctual with our time, so appreciate that. And this will be a great start. We've certainly had the opportunity to have all sorts of media discuss our transportation policy throughout the last year, and it'll be enjoyable to move this forward. Certainly would like to start out with just introductions, and if we could, I would appreciate just a brief introduction of who you are, where you represent, and if there's any other pertinent information you'd really like to share with the group. But for right now, let's start with that. And I would really like to start with our staff. Pages, maybe could you come up and introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Marco Lanz, being page.
I'm Sam Moyer, and this is my first year as a committee page.
Well, welcome, and welcome to the committee. Certainly our staff, we know, keeps this whole place running, and we appreciate their efforts. And why don't we start here, Brian?
Brian Farrow, GMP Research.
Jim, why don't we start and go right around the table?
Sorry, I came in a little late. Jim Knobloch, I'm an ex officio representative on the committee.
Mark Anderson, I've been on the committee on the policy for the last term, going into my second.
Mark. Joe Atkins, my maiden voyage in transportation, a representative of Heights, Mendota Heights, Sunfish Lake, and Eagan.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Frank Hornstein from District 61, which is parts of downtown and southwest Minneapolis. I'm also the co-lead for the DFL and this committee, and look forward to working with you.
Good morning. My name is Mike Sundin. I represent District 11A, which is Carlton County. Essentially, this is my second shot at the transportation issues. Everything I know about transportation, I learned from this guy right here. So.
That's going to be problematic.
Hi, I'm John Kosnick from Lakeville, first term, and honored to take over from Mary Liz Holberg.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm Jim Nash from District 47A, which is Western Carver County, and excited to be here.
I'm Abigail Whalen, representing 35A, Anoka and Ramsey, and it's also my first term.
I'm Clark Johnson. I represent District 19A, which is all of Nicollet County, part of Mankato and Kasota in Le Sueur County. And transportation is just a key critical issue in my district, and I'm glad to serve on this committee and look forward to work with you all to solve it this year.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Andrew Lee. I'm the nonpartisan House fiscal staff for this committee.
I'm Mr. Chair and members. I'm Matt Burris with nonpartisan House research.
I'm Natalie Cicchini, and I'm the committee legislative assistant.
I'm Tim Kelly. I represent District 21A to southern Minnesota, towns of Red Wing, Cannon Falls, Zumbrota, Wabasha, and Goodyear. And this will be my fourth term.
I'm Joe Marble. I'm the committee administrator.
I'm John Petersburg. I'm the vice chair of the committee. I also represent 24B, which is Oatana-Waseca, south of here, along 35.
I'm Denny McNamara, serving my seventh term. I live in Hastings, and it's my first term on this committee. Excited to be here.
Hi, Steve Draskowski. I represent 21B, which includes portions of Wabasha, Goodhue, Winona, and Dodge County. We have in southeast Minnesota the highest density of bridges of anywhere in the state.
Interesting. Connie Bernardi. I represent the communities of Fridley, New Brighton, and Spring Lake Park, and Anoka and Ramsey counties.
Good afternoon. Tim Sanders, 37B, Blaine.
Good afternoon, Mark Uglum, 36A, represent the city of Champlin and parts of Coon Rapids.
Eric Lucero, 30B, first term, represent the cities of Albertville, St. Michael, Hanover, Otsego, and the Wright County part of Dayton, which is where I'm from.
Kim Norton, I represent half of Rochester, 25B, and this is my fifth term, but my very first time on transportation, though I've carried quite a bit of public safety, transportation public safety legislation.
Hello, Jeff Howell, District 13A, which is wraps around basically the outskirts of St. Cloud to the south and west. Glad to be here, second term with transportation, and bring about a little over 20 years of military transportation experience to the board.
I'm Alice Hausman. I represent two neighborhoods in St. Paul, St. Anthony Park and Como Park, and three suburban cities, Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, and Roseville, and spend all my time on infrastructure between capital investment and transportation. And so I'm a strong believer, as Representative Johnson mentioned, that it's all about an economically healthy and competitive state. And when our DFL caucus researcher introduces herself, you might want to ask her what her husband's name is.
I'm Jenny Nash, DFL Caucus Research, and my husband's name is Jim. And we've been married for 25 years.
We've never met. That's what he says, too.
Yeah, Ron Earhart, I represent most of the city of Edina.
Linda Runbeck, and I represent a couple of suburban cities along 35W, about 6 miles worth, Llano Lakes, Blaine, and so on. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you all of you for that. I already like the tone of this. As you can tell, we will not have a seating chart. We're all adults here, but as we look around, we're already interspersed, and that's one of the things that I think about from a transportation standpoint. It really has not been a real partisan issue. I think we all believe in transportation and understand the needs of the state, and that's why we're here. So we have a number of representatives who have a lot of experience, and we certainly appreciate that. There's a number of us who are just starting out on transportation, and we'll look to you as veterans for all your experience, and please share that. And as you're sitting around, I would encourage you to maybe, I know we're creatures of habit, but try a different seat. Introduce yourself to someone you haven't met and visit with them, and that will help our committee operate even better. So I appreciate that. Just a couple of housekeeping things. We will, as I said, try and stay punctual because just to be respectful of the time, certainly with all of the work being done too, we do have to make sure that we get in and get out of the committee rooms at the right time. So we'll need to make sure that we do that. I think we've all been around in meetings long enough now to know that before you get in, please have your cell phones turned to, as Representative Beard would say, to stun, not phase. those are just a couple of things. When we start getting into, you'll also have these. Are the rules in the? We gave a copy of the rules in your packet, so you'll see those. When we get into amendments, we will have a 24-hour rule. And we will try and move debates along and make sure that we're not having anyone take over the debate or from a time standpoint. But we do have a lot of work to do. And I think as this has kind of played out, as we said, in just the opinion from myself here, is that we have a couple of things going here. One, I believe, is a short-term need when we're talking about the biennium and what our responsibilities are in putting together a budget for transportation. But there's also been a lot of discussion on our long-term need and our structural balance or imbalance in the formula. And I do believe those are two separate issues. So you'll maybe see the tone of the committees as we go forward, at least initially, that's the way we're approaching that. But I think that as we discuss that, any ideas that you have, we certainly look forward to that. It's not taken as criticism. It's just if anybody has an idea, we appreciate the ability to talk about that and to improve the committee and how we're going. So with that, we're going to start our committee process here with an introduction from Mr. Burris and Mr. Lee. So if you'd like to take the witness table, I appreciate that. And really what we will do, we will go over some of the basic structure of transportation, and these individuals have a wealth of experience, and we look forward to working with both of you. So Whoever would like to start?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Andrew Lee, and my colleague from House Research is Matt Burris. Today we'll be going over highway finance, the basic structure, and some of the distribution and bonding issues that go along with highway finance. And then in the next hearing, we'll be covering transit finance and some other committee accounts.
Mr. Lee, excuse me, before you start, maybe one thing we should talk about, just about questions and how we proceed here. If there really is a clarifying question, certainly if you get, will you be doing that,
Jim? Yeah.
Get our Mr. Marble's attention, he'll put you on the list. We'll try and do that so it doesn't interrupt your flow of it, but if it's just a clarifying question, if we want to get more in depth, either we'll take it here, or I'm certain either Mr. Lee or Mr. Burris would talk to you offline if you want to get certainly more in depth too. So that's how we'll proceed. Thank you
Mr. Chair and members, and we're certainly more than happy to meet with members whenever they have questions. So to start off, the highway finance structure in Minnesota mirrors the hierarchy of roads in Minnesota. So the largest funds are usually reserved for the highest magnitude roads. Those are the trunk highway system.
Put the mic here.
Sorry. Can you hear that better?
There you go.
That's better. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Chair, members. So the trunk highway system, as in trunk of a tree, includes roads that are interstates, U.S. routes. Those are roads that have the black and white U.S. shield marker. And while those are federally designated routes, those are roads that are owned and operated by the state, by MnDOT. It also includes Minnesota State Highways. Those are roads that have the Minnesota logo at the top of the road sign. But there's also a funding structure for locally owned and maintained roads, county roads, and county road highways, and municipal state aid highways. Go to the next one. The defining characteristic of highway finance in Minnesota is that the vast bulk of the funds are constitutionally dedicated statutory, or there's a statutory framework for their appropriation. There is a small amount of general fund appropriation in the Transportation Finance Committee account, and that is mostly for transit, rail, and the Department of Public Safety. Local roads are funded mostly by local property taxes, local assessments, and federal aid. But again, there's also the state aid piece of that. That's the constitutionally dedicated formula. This flow chart is the constitutional framework of highway finance. And one way to look at this is kind of as a sources and uses. So at the very top, all those boxes are sources for highway finance. And at the bottom are the various funds that directly spend money on highways. So at the top, you can see federal aid, other sources, miscellaneous, and then the three main state taxes for transportation, and they all flow into the HUTDF, or Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. This structure, for the most part, is all spelled out in the Constitution. So changing a piece of this would require a constitutional amendment. And kind of what that means in a practical sense is that if the legislature wanted to increase the gas tax but only have that increase go to county roads, say, it could not do that without a constitutional change. And likewise, money that is deposited into the trunk highway account or the municipal state aid street account cannot be transferred for another use, with a few exceptions that we'll get into later. Go to the next one. So moving into the revenues, the three main revenue sources for transportation, and all three of these are constitutionally dedicated, are the motor fuels tax or gas tax, the registration tax or tab fees, and the motor vehicle sales tax, also known as MVEST. The motor fuels tax, which is currently at 28.5 cents per gallon, is an excise tax. And what that means is that the tax is not a tax on the price of gasoline, but rather it's a tax on the number of gallons that is consumed, and it's collected at the wholesale level. I should note that other types of fuel are taxed based on their energy content, and a small amount, about 2.5% of the total gas tax revenues, are transferred to other funds because they're attributed to non-transportation uses, such as snowmobiles, ATVs, boats, and most of those transfers go to the DNR. And 100% of gas tax funding in the state is constitutionally dedicated for roads. And point of clarification, sometimes people are a little bit confused of whether or not gas tax all goes to roads. At the state level, it's all constitutionally dedicated towards roads, but at the federal level, a small piece of the 18.4 cents in the federal gas tax goes to transit, but the vast bulk of it goes to roads at the federal level. So this is a chart showing some recent changes in the gas tax rate. You can see going back to 1988, it was at 20 cents, and then in 2008, with the last major piece of transportation increase revenue, there's a phase-in that brings it up to the 28.5 cents a gallon that it is today. The registration tax, or TAB fees, is an annual tax on vehicles in the state. The rate is set at $10 plus a 1.25% of the manufacturer's base price, which is depreciated over the life of the car until it reaches minimum after 10 years, and the minimum tax is $35 a year. Trucks are taxed based on weight, and like the gas tax, the TAB fees are constitutionally dedicated only for roads. The third major transportation tax is the Motor Vehicle Sales Tax, or MVEST. That is a tax that is paid in lieu of the state general sales tax on buying a motor vehicle, new or used. That's at 6.5%. So in other words, rather than paying both the state general sales tax and this tax, this is only, you're paying only this tax when you buy a new or used vehicle. There's been some recent changes to it. In 2006, there's a constitutional amendment passed that dedicated 100% of the revenues for MVEST to transportation sources. Before that, it was deposited into the state general fund, with a piece of that going towards transportation starting in about 2002, but that was not constitutionally dedicated. There are some limitations and some requirements in that constitutional amendment that said that no more of the revenues, no more than 60% of the revenues from that tax will go to highways, and no less than 40% will go to transit. So what that practically means is that the legislature could increase the amount that goes to transit at the expense of what goes to roads, but not pass those thresholds. And currently, if you'll go to the next slide, it is 60% is going deposited into highways and 40% to transit. And there's a breakout within that 40% between the Twin Cities metropolitan area and Greater Minnesota Transit. And I should note that the Twin Cities metropolitan area transit also includes grants to the suburban transit providers as well as Metro Transit. The next chart gives you a sense of scale of these three main taxes. With the gas tax on the lowest on the low side of the bar chart, bringing in about $850 million. About the registration tax, about $600 million, and then this only shows the highway piece of the motor vehicle sales tax at the top there. And I think it would be useful if you could look in your packet. You'll see a large sheet like this. You could pull that out. This chart shows a history of the three major taxes, and you can kind of see that the three major taxes all behave slightly differently from each other. The top is the motor is the gas tax, and I've noted the various increases in the gas tax going back to 1974. I've also highlighted recession years on the bottom, so you can kind of see that for the most part, the gas tax is relatively flat, relatively stable, and owing to the fact that it is an excise tax, it doesn't increase with the price of gas. It will only increase if more people are consuming the fuel or if the rate is increased. And I've also added in a trend line showing inflation. In the second chart below that, you can see the motor vehicle registration tax, or TAV fees, which does seem to track to inflation. And you can note that some pretty recent changes have affected it. In the 2000 session, there was a cap at the total amount that could be paid to TAV fees, and that reduced it a bit. And that reduction, though it doesn't show up here, was backfilled by general fund at the time. But then that cap was later removed in the 2008 legislation, and you can see it slowly increasing again. The reason it didn't jump up kind of to make pace with that was because there was a hold harmless provision for vehicles that were purchased, you know, kind of before that piece of legislation. And then on the bottom you can see the motor vehicle sales tax, and I don't have an inflation line in here because it's split out in different ways. So basically everything from before the fiscal year 2001 was when it was 100% going to the state general fund. And then you can see amounts going to HUTD and transit. And while those were credited towards the motor vehicle sales tax, those were essentially a general fund appropriation that was just called from the motor vehicle sales tax, but it was not constitutionally dedicated. And then you can see in 2006 the phase-in of those revenues. But what you should notice on the motor vehicle sales tax is that it is quite a bit more volatile than the other three taxes. And there's one smaller highway revenue, transportation revenue tax that has had quite a bit of legislative changes in the past two sessions, and that is the motor vehicle lease sales tax. So that is the tax that is paid in lieu of the sales tax or the motor vehicle sales tax on leasing a car, and that's at the normal rate at 6.875%. It is partially allocated to transit, but the first $32 million of the revenue is deposited into the state general fund. And then anything in excess of that is distributed half for Greater Minnesota Transit and half for five of the seven metropolitan counties, county roads that exclude Hennepin and Ramsey County. And the distribution within those five are by population. Some other sources, general fund appropriation, again, like I said, most of that goes into transit and DPS. The state also receives federal aid for the trunk highway system, the trunk highway, since a very large system, has kind of other miscellaneous revenue having to do with construction permits, penalties, sale of property, and also there's a small amount of revenue from traffic citations. So again, this chart is to kind of give you a sense of where the money comes from, kind of trying to show this in a few different ways. I will note on the federal line, that's kind of a all federal spending in Minnesota, and only about $550 million is directed towards MnDOT for spending on state highways, and the rest is local or kind of other. So if you go to the next one. This, again, is a pie chart to kind of give you a sense of the relative scale and of highway finance of the major taxes. With that, I'll hand it over to Mr. Burris.
The next piece we'll talk about, Mr. Chair and members, again, Matt Burris with Howard Research.
Excuse me, Mr. Burris. We do have a question from St. Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lee, just one clarifying question in regards to the sales tax collection. Is that also on individual sales or just strictly to business sales for sales tax on tabs on transfers of vehicles?
Mr. Lee.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg. Do you mean like what? Business purchases for vehicles or?
Well, what I was referring to is when an individual sells a car to another individual, is there sales tax collected on that, or is it only from a dealer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, yes, I believe there is a tax that is supposed to be paid when individuals transfer between themselves. There are exceptions, family.
Thank you.
Representative Knobloch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're taking a break asking a question, can I go back to slide 13 in terms of the lease sales taxes? You said the first $32 million goes to the general fund, and then it's split between Greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities. How much is that amount that is split?
Just a moment.
Or how much was it in the last, you know, biennium, or what you project for the next biennium, whatever is easiest?
Mr. Chair and Representative Knobloch, fiscal 14, it was $22 million split between, or that was went into each, so about $44 million in total. That was the transportation distribution. I should note that that is a very, very, very volatile tax, and the numbers swayed, I think, by almost $20 million between two forecasts. That's part due to the kind of the nature of what's being taxed, but also because the Department of Revenue doesn't actually know how much of the sales tax is leased activity. It estimates based off of the data that they have available, but that's essentially an estimated number.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Back to slide 7, the other exception to, you know, we say it's constitutionally dedicated to roads and highways. There's one exception that is written into the Constitution, that revenue attributed to non-highway use for snowmobiles and ATVs. How did they get around that constitutional issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, the legislature established these allocations on the basis of a couple of studies, and there have been a couple of updates over the years in identifying how much motor fuel use was attributed or estimated to be non-highway use. And the part of the rationale, I think, behind that was that the language of the Constitution required that all motor fuel used for highway purposes goes into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, so that motor fuel that's been purchased for a non-highway use could be refunded, such as with some farm fuel, or allocated to these other accounts. So that's been a decision of the legislature and a statute put into place and updated a little bit over the years.
And Mr. Chair, and nobody has ever tested that in court?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I'm not aware of a court case that has that has been on point with that.
All right, thank you, Mr. Burris. If you'd like to continue.
And Mr. Chair and members, so we are on slide 17. Mr. Lee had touched on this earlier. I'll just go over a couple of the constitutional funds again, and then we'll start in on the distribution side of this structure. The first of these funds is the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. This is constitutionally established, and it is essentially a container and an allocator. For the most part, there aren't appropriations made directly out of this fund. The three core highway revenues flow into this and then get allocated and distributed to the other funds. Those other funds being three core highway system funds that had been touched on earlier. Again, these are constitutionally established as well. The first is the Trunk Highway Fund, so that's for the state trunk highway system, which is administered and managed by MnDOT. The County State Aid Highway Fund, or CASA Fund as it's sometimes referred to, is funding for the county state aid system. And then the Municipal State Aid Street Fund is the third of these, and that is for the municipal system. One thing worth noting with both the county state aid and municipal state aid funds is these are funding streams for the state aid systems on county and municipal roadways. There's actually a distinction between state aid roads and other roads that are maintained by counties and cities. There are some constitutional restrictions around the share of the roadways, the county state aid roadways, as well as municipal roadways that can be part of these state aid systems. So this is a funding stream, but not the only funding stream. It's the main source of transportation, or one of the main sources, I should say, of transportation aid to the counties and to the cities. Moving then into the distribution, we've touched a little bit on how there's a constitutional framework that underpins this. We'll get into a little bit more on some of the examples and aspects of that. And there are a number of statutory provisions that also underlie the financing framework. As mentioned, the HUTD fund contains the revenues and then distributes out. And the distribution out of the HUTD, the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, has two main parts. This is a constitutional component, this split between 95% and 5%. There are a couple of set-asides that happened before this, but conceptually it's really this 95 and 5. So first, the 95% distribution, obviously 95%, that's most of it. This is the allocation into the Trunk Highway Fund, the CASA Fund, and the MSAS, or Municipal State Aid Street Fund. If you've heard 62299, that's one of the various formulas that float around in transportation finance. And this is, another constitutional component. So 62% of the 95% distribution goes into the Trunk Highway Fund. 29% goes into the County State Aid Highway Fund, 9% into the Municipal State Aid Street Fund. So that's the 95% distribution. And that's the constitutionally established side of it. The 5% set aside is also constitutionally identified, but there's a bit more flexibility on this side of the overall distribution. The funding can go into any of these three core funds that we've been discussing, but the allocation formula can't just be changed by the legislature on an annual basis. There's a six-year sort of holding period. The last change for this occurred in 2009, and the formula that was put into place at that time was to allocate a portion to town bridges and town roads. You can see the allocation formula, or the percentages here, and then put a portion into something called the flexible highway account. That flexible highway account provides funding for a couple of different purposes. That's largely determined by MnDOT and the legislature. Proposal put forth by the governor. Allocation is to some extent usually baked into their built into the biennial budget process. A portion of the funds goes to counties in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. That's been administered based on the population, proportional share of population of the various counties, but excluding cities of the first class. A portion of these flexible highway account funds have also gone towards turnbacks. MnDOT has various trunk highways that are, in some estimation and under some analysis, not really a good fit as part of the trunk highway system and a better fit under to exist or switch over as county roads or municipal state aid streets. And under agreements with the local units of government, this is a funding stream where MnDOT can fix up some of those roads, bring them up to the standards that are in place under the state aid system, and then pass the jurisdiction off to local units of government. There are also local road improvement, regional significance funding categories or kind of potential uses of the flexible highway account funds. That's also specified in the statutory language around the flexible highway account. We started touching on aid to local government. And this is really the CASA fund and the Municipal City and Street Fund, the Town Bridge and Town Road accounts. These are funds that are administered by MnDOT. MnDOT, following requirements that the legislature has set into statute, as well as some administrative rules that the agency has created, handles the distribution and, to some extent, oversight of the projects that are then undertaken with these funding streams. A lot of the distribution is driven by statutory formula, so these aren't discretionary grant programs of MnDOT's. Really, they're following a distribution framework that is set out, and we'll be walking through some of that next. A lot of the components in the formula-based distribution are based on proportional shares, and for the most part, the funds are distributed as direct aid. It's kind of the money going out the door from MnDOT to counties and cities. There are a couple of set-aside type categories for disaster, other unforeseen circumstances, research, and the like. Looking at the funds going to the counties, through the county state aid allocation, there are actually two distinct formulas that are in place. The first is known as the excess fund. This refers to additional revenue that was generated as a result of the motor vehicle sales tax constitutional amendment, as well as funding changes that happened as part of the last major legislative initiative in transportation finance, which was the 2008 legislation. So conceptually speaking, the excess sum is kind of the new revenue that resulted from the latest round of changes that happened in 2006 to 2008 in transportation finance. And that formula is allocated on the basis of the share that each county has of vehicle registrations throughout the state. 40% of the money is allocated on that vehicle registration component, and then 60% is allocated on a construction need component. That need is a agreed upon amount that the counties kind of in through a process that MnDOT and the counties undertake evaluate the basis of how to calculate what funding would be necessary for each county to get up to a common standard of kind of state of condition of the respective county's roads. The second piece of this county state aid allocation formula is the apportionment sum, and there are a couple of components to it. 10% of the funds are allocated just equally, even split across all of the counties. And then, again, vehicle registration is one of the pieces. The total number of lane miles is proportionally divided up, and that's accounts for 30% of the funds that are available, just allocated proportionally. And then again, construction needs is another piece of this formula. With the funds going to the cities, there's also a statutory formula, somewhat similar. Population is half of accounts for half of the funds, and construction need is again an element. And there's a constitutional restriction on the minimum population. So cities need to have a population of 5,000 in order to be eligible for the municipal state aid funds. There are a couple of exceptions that have been established in statute. The most recent referring to situations where a city has had been at a population of above 5,000 and then dropped following a census. And so there's a statutory provision was put in a couple of years ago that allows for a kind of phase out of funding for cities facing that type of situation. Bonding is another area of transportation finance that we're going to cover today. So this is kind of moving away from the sources and uses of the highway financing structure and talking a bit about another finance area in transportation. bonds are a form of debt. So it's a debt obligation that the state takes on and then repays with some form of revenue in the future. So it allows for front-loading money and then paying off the kind of the money that's been brought up so that projects can happen sooner and the payments are spread across a period of time. This occurs through legislation that specifically authorizes and authorizes bonds of various types and then appropriates the proceeds for projects or programs. And in transportation, there's an important distinction between trunk highway bonds and just other general GO bonding, general obligation bonding. And this, again, follows from a constitutional structure. Trunk highway bonds are established or authorized in the Constitution. And under the interpretations that are in place currently, the proceeds from those bonds can only be used on the trunk highway system. And the flip side of that is other general obligation bonds, the proceeds from those can only be used outside of the trunk highway system. So the structure is largely a firewall between trunk highway bonds and just general obligation bonds.
Mr. Burris, if you could just speak to maybe some of the limitations the department has there in regards to levels of bonding that we're at, or Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and members, with regard to trunk highway bonding, MnDOT has a policy that is not in statute or is not a constitutionally spelled out policy that they would like to have less than 20% of state sources that go into the trunk highway fund, so the fund that goes to run trunk highways absent federal spending. They would like to have less than 20% of state sources that amount, they would like 20% of their spending that is attributed to state sources to be no more than that, to be spent on debt service, servicing trunk highway bonds. So that's kind of the ceiling is based off of how much we're paying to service bonds that have been issued in past years. And currently, MnDOT is spending about with the bonds that have already been authorized and that they're issuing now, they are going to reach about 17.5% of state sources that money attributed to state sources being spent on debt service in fiscal 17, and then it starts to decline after that. So very roughly speaking, and it all depends on how much what interest rates are in the bond market when they're selling the debt. Very, very, very roughly, about $100 million of trunk highway bonding is equivalent to about $10 million annually in debt service. And that, again, is dependent on a lot of other factors. So that kind of explains the limit.
Yes, just thank you, Mr. Lee. And just to say that there's other factors here in regards to just what those levels would be. And also, that's just the state source of revenue and has nothing to do with the federal, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Representative Nash.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Burris, Mr. Chair. Municipalities have the ability to borrow ahead 5 years on their MSA funding to use towards a project that is deemed appropriate. Can you explain the funding mechanism for those forward years?
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I'll have to get back to you with some detail on that, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hugo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on slide 23. Mm-hmm. Linda, you'll like this one. With the aid to local units of government, and we talk about MnDOT distributing these funds, what role does the Met Council have to play in this, and how is that statutorily playing into the distribution of these highway funds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, the Met Council is involved with allocations of both federal and some of the state dollars in the highway world with respect to MnDOT Metro District's decision making. That's trunk highway. A lot of the state aid in the context of this slide and the discussions of the CASA fund and municipal state aid street fund are administered by MnDOT but are kind of outside of the Met Council's purview. But so the Met Council is involved with road related decision making as part of the TAB process and the regional solicitation that they do for funding projects through sources of federal aid.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to follow up, how is that codified in statute or law with the role of the Met Council?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, the TAB is established through state statute, and it reflects, it's a reflection of federal law requirements around MPOs. As far as the specifics of decision making, I'm not recalling offhand a lot of detail on beyond kind of that framework for who makes the decisions. Process-wise, there are specifics on light rail transit, project development, and so I guess I'm not recalling other specifics.
Okay.
In that world, but I would defer. I know someone from the Met Council is here, and I would defer to them if you wanted to dig in a little bit further with that.
Well, in the interest of time, I just had the questions, so thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Burrs, going back to the county stadium, the trunk highway funds, is there any particular formula as to how the limit or maximum miles per county? What I'm getting at, is there an equity in state roads in each county?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, there's a constitutional limit on the total number of miles. I'll have to double check, but I believe that there's nothing specific as to the number that is a minimum or a maximum on a county by county or on a local kind of distributional basis. There is an oddity with the trunk highway system in that the system is spelled out, and it was originally spelled out in the Constitution. There was a constitutional amendment that shifted that, had resulted in that shifting to statute. The route designations actually have a constitutional status. So in a sense, the entire trunk highway system is constitutionally designated. Via statute, the legislature has added on and modified aspects of the route. But that reflects not the requirements around how much of the trunk highway system has to go through each county or something like that. That's more the historical circumstance of how the state's highway system came about.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I'd like to say, Mr. Barris, Mr. Lee, I've met with you a few times over the last few years, and your involvement and participation in this committee is a big asset, and I really appreciate you being able to keep us on track and keeping track of all of the complicated finances here. My question relates back to a couple of previous slides talking about county state aid and the municipality state aids, in which bulk of that was determined based upon construction needs. And I was just wondering, is there any process that has been set up or parameters as to how the construction needs actually are determined by the department and whether or not that is just a grant-type program or et cetera, just for clarification?
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, there is a process in place. There is a screening board that evaluates the data coming from each of the counties with respect to the county needs, and data coming from the cities with respect to the city need, and sort of, in a sense, serves as kind of a check against what kind of information each of the locals are submitting. MnDOT doesn't make a lot of the decision around the, they're just following the formula as far as allocating the funds, and in determining the needs, that's also largely a locally driven process, is my understanding. MnDOT's role is more around the state aid standards and the kind of engineering details behind when a project is funded through state aid dollars, you know, what requirements go into place with the engineering of, you know, the materials they have to be used, slopes and spacing and all the kind of engineering-y details behind that.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for a quick follow-up, so if the total need over all of the 87 counties is, say, $150 million, and there's only $90 million in this setup, would they each get prorated, or would there be a priority set up for who gets the funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, it's a proportional kind of allocation. So the total need is to maintain, develop and maintain the system, I think, over 20 years. So it's kind of getting everyone to the same theoretical number that you can then figure out what the proportional amounts would be across the counties or across the cities.
Right. Representative Hausman.
Mine is sort of a follow-up to Representative Mason's question. The slide 25, just clarifying, when you say apportionment sum formula and then in parentheses remainder of funds, does that mean only the 5% set aside that this these percentages apply to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, thank you. I neglected to explain the connection between the two formulas for the county state aid allocation. And the way to calculate that is to identify the excess sum, and then you've got the total, subtract off the excess sum, and then the remaining amount is this apportionment sum. So the apportionment is the bulk of it. It's maybe 70%, or don't quote me on that, but somewhere in that kind of territory. But that's arrived at by first looking, figuring out how much the kind of new revenue is and is allocated under the excess sum.
Does he have something else to add?
Sorry, just to Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, the excess from the new revenue from the 2008 legislation.
So just to clarify, because I think your question was getting at how do we assure equity. So the formula component has vehicle registration, meaning how many in that county register their vehicles, lane miles, and then under municipal state aid, there is also population. So there are components to that. I just didn't know if all those percentages apply not only to the 5%, but the 95%.
Sir, Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, maybe point of further clarification. The excess sum and the apportionment sum is outside of the 95-5 formula. This is only the formula within the county state aid highway distribution. So it's only within the 95 distribution. So in other words, kind of to explain it, is that of the new revenue from the 2008 legislation, of that new revenue that went into the county state aid highway fund, that new revenue is the excess sum. And then everything before that, those kind of like existing resources before the 2008 legislation, is the apportionment formula.
And
Representative Burris, or Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, I might add that I think it's fair to say that when the excess sum component was added on as part of the 2008 legislation, part of the consideration behind that were perceptions of equity in how the county state aid was allocated. And so the second formula, I think part of the idea was to address some of those equity concerns by establishing a different formula that would have different impacts across in how much goes across the counties.
And then, Mr. Chair, I would just add a little bit on the bonding piece. I don't know how many of you were on this committee during the Pawlenty period, but Governor Pawlenty was going to increase the projects we could do by using federal money, and he said that we'd use that as the debt service, kind of what you were describing that local governments can do. That he said we'd do that, but the state would do that too. We would use that to pay debt service on fast tracking some projects. So I remember we did a big spreadsheet, and I don't know if either of the two gentlemen at the table were here to do that spreadsheet. What we discovered is it didn't take very long before the cost of those projects would overrun the amount coming in from the federal government. So we would be in the red. There was not sufficient federal money coming in to actually pay the debt service. So that was a solution that sounded good until you looked out a number of years and then you discovered the math just didn't work. And so I think that whole issue of borrowing on transportation we have to be so careful about. And the one that I have a little bit of anxiety about, we already, by the way, Mr. Chair, the Chair would have an interest in making certain that on slide 28 you also point out that ports are part of traditional geobonding for this. But the other thing that Governor Pawlenty did, in addition to just measuring debt capacity by saying we're going to do 3.5% of personal income, he said we want to quantify all debt, and then we want to have a limit there too, a percentage limit. What that meant is suddenly the amount we borrowed for trunk highway bonding and Viking Stadium and tobacco securitization bonds and all that suddenly was in competition with our traditional general obligation bonding, and has put us in something of a problem when we fund for higher education or wastewater infrastructure, whatever. The more we borrow for transportation, the less debt capacity is available, at least under those existing guidelines that we have. The less is available for all of the traditional things we have bonded for. Higher education has always been a biggie, wastewater infrastructure, all the state agencies. So I think this is the component I suspect we'll spend more time on as some of the revenue plans flow. I saw that the Senate bill, for example, that was introduced this morning, I think they talk about hundreds of millions of dollars of general obligation bonding for local roads and bridges. The more you do of that, the greater strain it puts on debt capacity for everything else.
Thank you. Would you like to continue, Mr. Bruce? Oh, sure. One more question.
That'd be great.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bruce, is there dollars sitting waiting for projects that we've authorized bonding for, but the bonds have not been let? And how much does that, you know, account? How much is that in total?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, we were actually going to touch on that in the next slide with respect to the trunk highway bonds. And that gets at a distinction between authorization versus issuances of the bonds. Okay. I mentioned earlier that that the bonding is authorized through legislative enactment specifying a project or funding for a program. And it then goes to Department of Management Budget and working with MnDOT as well as other state agencies with respect to other bonding to perform issuances. They do bond sales rounds of sales of bonds depending on the cash flow needs for projects that are upcoming. So the actual sale of bonds is largely a cash management issue for what's anticipated in the upcoming 6 month or upcoming time period before the next round of sales for the various projects that are bond funded. So currently there's $734 million in trunk highway bonds that are authorized. The bonds haven't been issued yet. Those are all program dollars, however, so MnDOT has identified projects that are under development at this point or, you know, kind of in the design or engineering process, but where there aren't cash, you know, payments to contractors necessary yet that would trigger the bond issuance. And then, Mr. Chair, I will just jump back then to a little bit more, back on slide 28, a little bit more about the distinction between trunk highway bonds and other GO bonding. Just a bit on the kinds of projects and programs that are funded or have traditionally been funded through these. On the trunk highway side, obviously, it's the trunk highway system that is benefiting from trunk highway bond dollars. So that's the state roads. It's, in some cases, very large-scale and expensive bridges. There are also some programmic initiatives that have that the legislature has enacted in the past couple of years. 2013 had corridors of commerce as an example, and that, I believe, was a $300 million authorization for bonding for projects throughout the state impacting freight and mobility as well as some expansion. Trunk highway bonding has been authorized both in transportation finance legislation, whether as a almost standalone bill or as part of a transportation budget, and bond authorizations have also occurred in capital investment legislation. So in the transportation world, general obligation bonds have there's been a mix of very specific projects, a particular bridge, specific airport expansion project, as well as programs. And this is one of the themes that you'll see in transportation more generally, transportation finance more generally, is a lot of the funding is programmatic rather than project specific in nature. So the local road improvement program, local bridge replacement and rehabilitation program, port development program, so that we're not missing out on ports here, are all examples of programs where funding is laid out as from the bonds for this purpose, but then it's left to the agency to actually implement and allocate funds out for the various specific projects that are then funded. What's listed in the slide, by the way, is just some examples. It's not the full breadth of what's been funded through trunk highway or general obligation bonding. And the GO bonds are, typically it's capital investment legislation that deals specifically with bonding and capital investment. And there is a different vote threshold. So under the Constitution, there's a 3/5 vote requirement for GO bonds. That's not the case for trunk highway bonds. We've covered authorization and issuances, so I'll just jump to the next slide, which hopefully gives you a little bit of the sense of going back historically what the bonding levels have been. So the trunk highway bonds are reflected in the gray or the bottommost of the three bars. Trunk highway bonding shows up first in 2008 and spikes in 2010. There's another larger amount in 2013. That's the Corridors of Commerce program. The kind of middle bar refers to local road and bridge bonding. So this is really just splitting out the general obligation bonding into local road and bridge as compared to other transportation facilities and programs. And so you can see from this history that's been a large component of the general obligation bonding.
Mr. Burris, that was one of my questions. So Corridors of Commerce was funded with GO bonds in 2013?
Mr. Chair and members, no, that was trunk highway bonding authorization. And it's this chart is when the bonds are actually sold and let, not when they're authorized. So the $400 million that you're seeing in 2013 in trunk highway bonding authorization is like the bonds actually being sold. I believe a piece of the $300 million Corridors of Commerce was part of that bond sale, and some more of it was the bond sale in 2014. But just to clarify, this is like when the cash is needed for projects. And so you can see in the ramp up in 2008, 2009, 2010, most of that and most of the continuing trunk highway bonding authorization was all authorized in 2008, but is being let in following years.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, members, my apologies. The distinction between these three bars seemed better before I got here.
One question, Representative Piesberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think maybe there does need to be a little bit of a clarification about Corridors of Commerce, because I believe we've used last year in 2014, there were some general obligation bonds that was also used for Corridors of Commerce, correct? And so I think Corridors of Commerce is one of those anomalies right now that is kind of between the two. And if you could clarify that, I think that's appreciative.
Mr. Chair and Representative Piesberg, I don't believe that any general obligation bonding was used for Corridors of Commerce because of the constitutional problem about using general obligation bonding on trunk highways. What I believe you might be referring to is that trunk highway cash was used in the 2014 session for the Corridors of Commerce program.
Thank you. Representative Knobler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee or Burris, whoever wants to answer this. Going back to slide 28, when you talk about specific MnDOT facilities, I assume you're talking about regional offices or salt sheds, things like that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, yes, that is correct. MnDOT has a number of truck stations and a district headquarters facilities. There's actually a fair amount of infrastructure for maintaining the roads, a lot of big trucks, a place to store them, salt, other materials. So over the years, there's at least the past 10 years or so, there's traditionally been some amount of funding specifically for redesign, reconstruction, improvements to the various facilities.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Burris, I guess I know that I think they've sometimes used just trunk highway funds generally for that as cash. I think they've sometimes bonded for that. That's correct. Is there any particular, you've got this listed as trunk highway bonds. Is there any reason that those could not be financed with general obligation bonds since they're not actually highways in and of themselves?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, I'm not sure on that. I'll need to get back to you on that question.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, one more question. I guess, do you have any sense in terms of like what's the average amount of money per year or per biennium going back, say, 10 years that we've spent on those sorts of facilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, again, I can get back to you on that.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Burris, please continue.
Mr. Chair and members, that brings us to a little bit of a recap and perhaps one more round of review and stepping back a little bit. There are a couple of characteristics that come out of transportation finance. We've touched on the constitutional framework and how there are constitutional components to a lot of the transportation finance structure. There are three main sources of highway revenue, so the motor vehicle sales tax, the gas tax, and the registration tax. And one thing about all three of those is that they can be viewed as a form of user financing. It's the users of the system, those who purchase vehicles, those who purchase fuel for use on roads. User financing is kind of one of the underlying principles that has been in place with transportation funding largely since its inception. So there's that connection to roadway type activities for the roadway revenue. The Trunk Highway Fund, the County State Aid Highway Fund, Municipal State Aid Street Fund are the three main funds that the money flows into and then back out of, and the flowing back out of is largely on a formula basis. That's driven by both the Constitution and statutory formulas that the legislature has enacted and maintained. We've also seen how the highway funding structure is largely non-general fund dollars. These are it's dedicated revenues going into the into highway and to some extent transit. Also touched on trunk highway bonds as a separate and kind of firewalled form of bonding compared to general obligation bonds, and noted that the types of bonding includes both project specific as well as programmatic. The project specific, I kind of just to touch on that a little bit more, project specific bonding has generally been with GO bonds. It's not been with trunk highway bonds. So historically the legislature when authorizing trunk highway bonds has specified it for a program and not for a specific project, whereas with the capital investment legislation it's been somewhat more of a mix of specific bridges or specific airport as compared to the local road improvement program or port development assistance program. So stepping back just a bit from the formulas, there are a number of elements that kind of provide implications for future legislative changes in transportation finance. One is that the funding sources themselves are constitutionally dedicated, and that's both to highways and to a mix, in the case of MBES, between highways and transit. The main highway funding distribution is also determined by the Constitution. So the gas tax, the registration tax, any amount of motor vehicle sales tax, if directed, has to go into the highway user tax distribution fund. And from there, the constitutional formulas, the 95 and 5 kicks in, and then after on the 95 side, the 62-29-9 formula kicks in. So what I'm trying to express here is that with a lot of the funding, the split on the highway side between the state and the locals is dictated by the Constitution. The core revenue already kind of specifies out how much goes to the state and how much goes to the locals. So there are flexible spots, but they tend to be, finance sources, but they tend to be the smaller amounts. So the motor vehicle lease sales tax, in comparison to these other funding sources, is a fairly small amount, but it's the most flexible. Same thing with the general fund. So if there are any further questions, we'd be happy to note those and probably get back to you. But we can address them here, too.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bruce, so it looks like the 62% for the trunk highway fund generates about $1 billion annually. Do you have numbers on what percent of that is spent on maintenance versus new roads or expansion, new lanes, et cetera? And would it be safe to say that it's the bonding money that is going for new roads? Again, expansion, new lanes. So one is maintenance and one is expanding roadway systems?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, I do not have numbers right off the top of my head on that, though I will note that in the transportation appropriations and appropriations bill, typically the legislature spells out appropriations within trunk highway for state road construction, for operations and maintenance, and so kind of the maintaining this current system and expansion. Sometimes the definition of those projects can be different. A large state road construction project may be maintaining existing number of lanes but completely replacing a stretch of roads that, is different from operations and maintenance. But I can get back to you with I think what you're asking.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Burris, Mr. Lee, just a clarifying question on if there were a new tax proposed, anything that's dedicated, would that require a constitutional amendment then? Anything that was dedicated to transportation?
Mr. Chair and members, it would. I guess I would to be able to answer that, I would need a little bit more on the nature of what tax. So if a motor fuels tax increase, you know, just a increase in the rate of the motor fuels tax, that would pretty clearly be dedicated solely to highways. A new tax that is unrelated to these constitutionally established ones that is in the transportation world would be less likely, but it would really depend on the specifics. And just by way of context behind that, that's largely something that gets there would be a court decision ultimately to get a final that the courts are, let me back up, the courts are the final arbiter on constitutional questions around this, and so it requires a some sort of challenge and court case. And absent that, you know, there are various sources where opinions can come from, but, you know, that would be the kind of ultimate decision-making body.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Knobloch.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, to follow up on that question of yours, if I could. So if we look at, I guess I don't recall the exact language of the Constitution on this, the wholesale tax that Governor Dayton has proposed, the wholesale tax on gasoline, sales tax at the wholesale level, is that something that would be constitutionally dedicated given the language we have in the Constitution?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, I'm not prepared to give give an opinion either way on that at this point. If you're looking for a legal analysis on the matter, I can bring that back to you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I suppose we'll probably be potentially getting into that. I guess do you know off the top of your head exactly what the wording of the Constitution is? Do you have it right there? That's probably a lot to ask.
Yeah.
All right, we'll go back to it later. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. Any further questions? And actually, Mr. Marble will also email this presentation to all of you, and we'll put this in electronic format for all of you, and we'll post that as well. So we will have that. We will have a continuation of this on Wednesday, where we will be meeting in the basement. So that's where we'll go back and forth on Mondays and Wednesdays there. So that'll take up part of the committee on Wednesday. We'll also have a presentation from the port authorities. Representative Hausman, you mentioned them. They'll be actually coming on Wednesday. And next week we will not have a meeting on Martin Luther King Day. So we will not meet on Monday. And Wednesday then we will have the discussion on the rail safety study that just was released. So that's what we have upcoming. Any other questions for the committee or clarifying items? All right. With that, we are adjourned.